Welcome to the Abridged Presidential Histories with Kenny Ryan, episode 36A, an interview on LBJ and Vietnam with Mark Lawrence. I'm excited to welcome Mark Lawrence to the show today. Mark is the director of the LBJ Presidential Library and Museum in my hometown of Austin, Texas, and he's the author of numerous books on Vietnam and U.S. international relations, including, most recently, The End of Ambition, The United States and the Third World in the Vietnam Era, which makes him the perfect person to discuss LBJ and the war in Vietnam with. Mark, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Kenny. It's great to be with you.
Thanks. First off, what inspired your interest in Vietnam?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've been doing this for a really long time, and it can sometimes be hard to remember why I got into this business. But, you know, I was born in 1965. I have no direct memories of the war or, you know, really of the controversies that played out around that time. But I think there was something about growing up in the immediate aftermath of Vietnam when, you know, everybody was talking about how important this was, right? What a momentous experience this was for the nation, what a turning point in American history it was. And of course, a lot of those claims continue to get made, you know, as I got into school and started to think about, you know, where the United States was in the world. And of course, this was the sort of closing stages of the Cold War when international affairs seemed like, you know, the most important thing someone like me could possibly study. So I think I just kind of absorbed, you know, a sense that that international relations were the thing I wanted to study. And this, you know, this was an important subject, and that Vietnam was somehow at the very center of the American experience in the last half century. And, you know, I remain very convinced of that. And it's really powered my career, I suppose, ever since, because I've approached Vietnam in different ways. But it's been usually at the heart of what I've been teaching about and writing about ever since.
So American involvement in Vietnam, it seems to really kind of sneak up on the U.S. You know, it's a slow burn from Truman to peak involvement under Nixon and LBJ. How does the United States really start to get pulled in there?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one I've spent a lot of time thinking about. My first work on Vietnam really had to do with those very early phases in the 1940s. And I think there are two more or less separate, related certainly, but separate calculations I think you have to factor in here to understand American motives in those early days when Americans were first becoming involved in Vietnam. One has to do with the conviction among American leaders in the closing stages of the Second World War and the early post-war period that the United States needed to be really active on the world scene. There was no corner of the world in that era that wasn't important to the United States. And this was a big departure in American history. But it's one of the many ways in which the Second World War is such a transformative experience for the United States. And above all, resuscitating a global capitalist economy in the aftermath of this enormous devastation of the Second World War was absolutely central to the way American leaders, not at first the American public necessarily, but certainly American leaders thought about what needed to happen after the fighting ended. And so Vietnam, a pretty obscure place that, you know, as the cliche would go, not many Americans could have found on a map, is a place that suddenly mattered because it was a resource-producing area. It provided rice that kept people fed across South and Southeast Asia, which were pivotal to especially the European economies. And the European economies, in turn, were essential to the United States as Americans thought about how to reconstruct the world order. So Vietnam simply mattered in the way a lot of previously obscure places mattered to Americans. But then the second part of the answer is, of course, the Cold War. Mm-hmm. So as Americans started to worry about communism in the mid and certainly by the late 1940s, anywhere where there was an insurgency or, you know, a fighting directed against Western interests was bound to draw American interests. And, you know, the roots of the fighting in Vietnam were incredibly complicated, but it was certainly not incorrect to believe that insurgency against the French, who were the colonial masters of Vietnam, was in part driven by communist expansion. Mm-hmm. So that communist threat, that threat that the communists might take over all of Vietnam and gobble up all those resources that I mentioned a minute ago, became by the end of the 1940s a really, really important consideration for American leaders.
Awesome. And so as that's happening, you know, as Vietnam starts to simmer, the United States starts to get involved late 40s through the 50s, LBJ, you know, he's a congressman and then a senator during that time. Do we know when Vietnam first really crosses his radar? When does he first become aware of the conflict in Vietnam? And what is his initial thought on it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And there's not a ton of evidence from, let's say, the late 1940s across the 1950s about LBJ's engagement with the Vietnam problem. But I think that's maybe not so surprising. LBJ, in my mind at least, was kind of a conventional mainstream Cold Warrior. Hmm. You know, he wasn't someone who thought very critically or creatively about international affairs. He was very much in the mainstream of American angst about communist expansion, what that could mean for American interests. So he kind of went with the flow, I think, on Vietnam as American anxiety about what was happening there increased across the 40s and then across the 1950s. As well. There's some evidence, especially around the Dien Bien Phu crisis in 1954, right, as the French army was really on the ropes and the end of the French Empire seemed to be at hand, that LBJ worried about the possibility that the United States might step in there and assume a major military role. He was aware of the argument that the United States really didn't have what it would take, at least at that moment, to wage war in Southeast Asia. But he believed certainly in containment, in the need to stand tall in South or Southeast Asia. I think it's fair to say he just wasn't sure Vietnam was necessarily the place to draw that line and make that stand. He would, of course, come later to the opinion that it certainly was.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was... I think to the extent he thought about Vietnam, well within the mainstream, but, you know, he could perhaps have been convinced in those early days that, you know, it was a place where Western prospects were so bleak that the line of containment should be drawn somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. So what's the situation in Vietnam when a few years later LBJ becomes president? And what were his immediate goals and strategies in relation to Vietnam when he, you know, it just lands on he is president? Kennedy's dead.
Yeah. So by that point in November 1963, South Vietnam, right? Vietnam had been divided in 1954 into North and South, and South Vietnam was the American ally that Americans were concerned to protect and defend. South Vietnam was really in serious trouble by the end of 1963. A major and ever-growing insurgency against the South Vietnamese government had been gathering steam across the early 60s. The South Vietnamese government wasn't performing very well in waging war against those insurgents or in sort of deepening its own legitimacy in the eyes of its own people. So all of the trend lines were going, from LBJ's standpoint, from an American standpoint, in terrible directions at the end of, yeah, of 1963. And in the minds of lots of American officials, it was becoming clear that if the United States was going to prevent South Vietnam from falling to the communists, the United States might have to take that next big step in its engagement in Vietnam and actually send in combat forces. Right. So for years, Americans had sent enormous amounts of economic aid and military aid as well, had sought to use all kinds of political influence to bolster the South Vietnamese government, had used covert operations, every tool in the toolkit, in other words, short of direct combat involvement. What started to register in 1962, 1963, is that the day might come when Americans, if they wanted to preserve an independent South Vietnam, we're going to have to take that use that final tool in the toolkit, if I can put it that way. Yeah. And so that was kind of the nature of the situation that LBJ inherited. He was keenly aware that in November 1964, he faced a presidential election and wanted to be elected in his own right.
Yeah.
So I think what you see across 1964, essentially in the first year LBJ was in office, is that he tried to keep a lid on Vietnam. He didn't want it to become too big an issue in a way that would damage his ability to get his domestic agenda passed or, you know, create unpredictable political forces that might interfere with his ability to get elected. Remember, his opponent was the ultra hawkish Barry Goldwater.
Right.
So a major war, you know, wasn't something that he believed would necessarily work to his political advantage. But once he was elected by a huge landslide in November 1964, you know, that's when I think he and his advisors really got serious about crossing that line toward a full-fledged combat role.
You know, I remember there's one point I've seen made that before Kennedy died and the months before, he had ordered a drawdown in Vietnam. And there's a claim that LBJ stopped that drawdown when he became president. I'm curious what truth there is behind that. What was going on with that moment?
Well, I don't. It's a great question, one that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. I think that there is not much evidence that JFK had a concrete plan to withdraw American troops. It's true that there was a scheme for withdrawing some American forces, but as best I can make out, this was part of an ongoing plan to cycle new units of American troops through Vietnam. It wasn't part of a master plan to withdraw.
Got it.
That said, I do think that JFK was a much more nuanced, subtle, and cautious figure when it came to the use of American force than LBJ was. So I think you can make an argument, I would certainly be open to it, that if JFK had lived, you would get a very different kind of American experience in Vietnam than you got with LBJ.
Thank you. So the experience LBJ did get is that on August 7th, 1964, Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, giving LBJ a blank check to do whatever he wanted in Vietnam. Where was American support for involvement in Vietnam at this point? And what did the American public generally know about Vietnam? Because this was an overwhelmingly, you know, popularly passed resolution in Congress.
Yeah, exactly. Unanimous in the House and just two votes against in the Senate. And I think that that reflected I don't want to say enthusiasm. It reflected a standard Cold War assumption within the American public that the appropriate way to respond to any sort of communist attack on American assets was with force, right? Was with determination. So when LBJ launched the airstrikes against North Vietnam as part of that Gulf of Tonkin episode, it was very popular. You know, I don't have the public opinion statistics at my fingertips here, but suffice it to say, it was very popular. Ordinary Americans, by and large, rallied around the flag and came, I think, quite readily to the conclusion, you know, the United States was doing what the Cold War demanded, what it had done in Korea and lots of other places up to that point in the Cold War, that was necessary to prevent, you know, sort of keep the communists in their box and defend American interests. I do think, though, you can make a case, and obviously you can make this case particularly with the great benefit of hindsight, that American support for a bigger role in Vietnam, despite the outward show of support, was thin, was weak, was potentially wobbly if this conflict turned into a real quagmire. And some American leaders were keenly attuned to this. They warned that, look, you may think that, you know, Americans are 100% behind a greater military role in Vietnam, but let's be careful because Americans, by and large, don't understand this enormously complicated place, what's going on politically. If this becomes a problem, if this drags on, you know, that support might wither away relatively quickly. So it's not that idea that was there. That was part of the discussion, no less than LBJ's vice president, Hubert Humphrey, was very attuned to this risk of intervention.
It almost feels like an analogy where if you ask somebody, hey, would you like some cake? They'd be like, of course, without thinking about it, I'd love some cake. But then if you showed them the cake and it was like clearly it had been left out for 3 months and it looked like terrible, they'd be like, maybe I don't want cake.
Yes, exactly.
I like to bring dessert into my analogies of politics.
I love that. I'm going to use that myself.
Thank you. So LBJ has this power. He has this authority to do what he needs to do in Vietnam, whatever he feels he needs to do in Vietnam. And over the coming years, he does increase American presence, increase American troops. Tell me more, though. Like, what is his role in this? What is his role in the and reasoning for the deepening American involvement in the war?
You know, there are some historians out there who have argued over the years that LBJ didn't know that much about foreign affairs. He was really he was really controlled by his advisors. They were the ones, you know, who were responsible for escalation in Vietnam. And I don't want to minimize their role. You know, people like Robert McNamara and Dean Rusk and so forth were important players in this story. But in my view, LBJ really was the central figure. You know, he was the one who made the decisions. He was the decider. he was the pivotal figure. And he was pretty gung-ho, I think, on escalation. That doesn't mean he wasn't aware of the risks and the concerns and even the dissent from that was being voiced by people around him. But I think he didn't give that dissenting advice all that much serious consideration. And I think there were two things that were really driving his decisions. One is something I mentioned before. I think at heart, he was a relatively conventional Cold War thinker. Mm-hmm. He believed in his core about the necessity of containing communism, about the risks of the domino idea, right? Mm-hmm. If you didn't hold Vietnam, suddenly Laos and Cambodia and Thailand and Indonesia, and in the worst cases, you know, India and Australia might fall to the communists. This was something that had been kind of in the air that LBJ had breathed across his entire political career. And he simply didn't have the creativity, I think, when it came to foreign affairs to question that in a way that maybe, arguably, someone like JFK was willing to do. The other thing I would put into the mix here, which I think is very important with LBJ, is that he was principally concerned about his domestic agenda, as we all know, right? The Great Society was LBJ's baby. That was where he wanted to make his mark and leave his lasting legacy in the United States. And I think many of us would probably applaud, you know, so many transformative elements of the Great Society as major steps forward for the country. But LBJ saw foreign policy, I think, including Vietnam, through a lens of domestic policy. He wanted to avoid taking missteps internationally in a way that would potentially create political problems for him. He didn't want to give his political opponents ammunition to say, well, LBJ's weak on communism. You know, he's an ineffective president. He's, you know, allowing the communists to make gains in places like Vietnam. He didn't want that. He didn't want to lose, of course, and suffer the consequences that might come with an actual defeat. But he also just didn't want this to be a big subject of discussion because he wanted to keep the American public and really Congress above all focused on Medicare, Medicaid, and civil rights, and the immigration bill, and the war on poverty, and all those other domestic programs that really, really mattered to him. So fighting in Vietnam, doing, in other words, what was necessary to avoid defeat in Vietnam, was central to his domestic agenda in a way that, you know, can be easy to miss if you silo, as I think we tend to do, foreign policy and domestic policy as totally separate realms. You know, let's remember LBJ was dealing with these things in a really intermingled way all the time, and to him, they were closely related.
When did that American support, that broad American support for Vietnam start to change? You know, when did people really start to look at that cake and say, maybe no? You know, was this a gradual change, or were there any key moments that really jolted the American public against the war?
It really was gradual. That's certainly the way I would describe it. I think there's been this tendency over the years to try to find, you know, sort of the key turning points that soured Americans on the war. And I don't want to say that there weren't important moments. I think the hearings that chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, J. William Fulbright, held in 1966, for example, were an important moment in alerting Americans to the problems in Vietnam. The Tet Offensive, you know, to fast forward to early 1968, was another moment when clearly, you know, the American public broadly was confronted with the reality of, you know, stalemate at best in Vietnam. But I think when you look at the statistics, look at the chart, look at the public opinion data, what really jumps out at me is that support for the war really dropped off fairly gradually. There was no sort of moment, you know, when things turn. I think it's a gradual trend that played out from mid to late 1965, when the war really started to get a lot of attention. And really that continued, you know, down into the Nixon period.
Why couldn't LBJ see what the American people saw? You know, and especially, as you say, when this is very much a domestic kind of motivator, when he sees that approval for the war dropping, why didn't he abandon the war? It could have, maybe, who knows, saved his presidency.
It's a great question. I think there's a couple of different answers that are important to think about here. One is that, you know, we tend to use, I do it all the time, you know, this term, the anti-war movement, as if it was just one thing. But we have to remember that LBJ, sure, confronted people who believed that the United States should, you know, cut its losses and get out of a failed enterprise. But there were also plenty of people who broadly were, you know, quote unquote, anti-war, who believed that the United States wasn't doing enough in Vietnam. And, you know, if the United States was going to be serious about this war, it should do more. It should use more force. So public opinion was quite complicated for LBJ, far more complicated, I think, than sometimes the simple, you know, dichotomy of anti-war, pro-war that some of us might hold in our heads would suggest. So he was navigating among a lot of different opinions about the war, some of which were urging him to do more, not less. And some of those people were really important to him politically. As well. But, you know, I think the bigger thing, you know, as other presidents have certainly experienced across American history, is that once you've committed American force and once, to put it kind of crudely, once Americans have started dying, it is very difficult, right, to dial it back and say, oops, you know, that was a mistake. Let's cut our losses. You know, I think that LBJ may have been right to think his political life would be over at that point, and he would be, you know, maybe the life of his political party would be over, because that would be such a blow.
Do we have a sense of, you know, because the people who are anti-war on either side, they had reasons for it. Do we have any sense of him really weighing those arguments and playing with them and considering them or dismissing them? Or was he just, you know, ears closed, committed to his path?
Yeah, I think it's somewhere in between the two, but maybe leans a little bit more toward the second scenario. I think he listened, you know, he read, he heard the chants, you know, he understood that people, including people very close to him, like the vice president, you know, were critical of escalation and were frustrated and angry. But I think that LBJ, as the war dragged on, became in a way defiant of people whom he felt had betrayed him in some way. Right? They had stood shoulder to shoulder to him when times were good, when they were passing all this transformative legislation in Congress, but then when he started to be criticized by people who had once been his close allies, I think it really made him very angry. And so LBJ, by the last year of his presidency, was quite a bitter man who wasn't in any mood to listen to people who he, you know, sort of thought of as his critics, and he kind of sided really in 1967, 1968 with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with his by now National Security Advisor Walt Rostow, who kind of bolstered him and stiffened his backbone and drove him to carry on with the war. They were the people he was really listening to.
Now, we've seen presidents with different level of involvement in the wars they presided over. You mentioned LBJ, you called him the decider earlier. Can you give me more detail on how involved was he and what was his involvement in the planning and strategizing of the Vietnam War?
He was pretty deeply involved. I do, though, think that it was nothing extraordinary in the annals of America, of presidential involvement in the conduct of America's wars. There is this idea, I think, that has been pushed over the years that LBJ was a kind of micromanager. Famously sat around over lunch with two or three advisors and chose bombing targets. And You know, some of that's been exaggerated. Sure, that happened, but I'm not really sure that's so different from the way, you know, other presidents behaved in connection with other wars. You know, Abraham Lincoln was pretty down in the details about the Civil War, and
yeah.
And I would say George W. Bush, maybe we'll learn more in the years to come, was pretty involved, you know, in some of the day-by-day details, decision-making about Iraq as well. So I think LBJ has come in for a lot of criticism because people have naturally wanted to understand why things went wrong in Vietnam. But, you know, I don't know that it was particularly outside the norm.
Cool. You were talking earlier about the Great Society, and I'd love to hit more on that. There's this great LBJ quote that I think it even kind of ties to the topic of your latest book I mentioned earlier. The quote goes, "If I left the woman I really love, the Great Society, to get involved in that bitch of a war on the other side of the world, then I would lose everything at home. But if I left that war and let the communists take over South Vietnam, then I would be a coward and my nation would be an appeaser, and we would find it both impossible to accomplish anything for anybody anywhere on the entire globe." I'm curious what you make of that quote. And then also, what impact did the Vietnam War have on LBJ's Great Society and his international aspirations beyond Vietnam?
Yeah, it's such a memorable quote, you know, it certainly points to something I think that's very real, which is that LBJ was in a bind. You know, he had these transformative ambitions in the domestic arena. And yet he could not escape the Cold War. he really wanted to defuse the Cold War and keep, not necessarily to end the Cold War, but to lower tensions so that he could focus on his domestic priorities. And Vietnam refused to let him do that. So it had to have been enormously frustrating for him to be sucked back in, you know, to a conflict that he so desperately wanted to avoid. You know, I think this quote captures something very real about his calculations. I think, as I mentioned before, he believed that he had to fight in Vietnam in order to preserve his political viability and the viability of his domestic agenda. A defeat in Vietnam, he worried, would empower his adversaries in a way that would make it very difficult for him to do much in the domestic arena. Where I think this quote is maybe problematic, where I think it could be, you know, it's misleading and maybe, you know, we should really question LBJ's understanding of his own behavior, is in his sense that he would absolutely, without question, have faced a massive public backlash if he had agreed to some sort of face-saving fig leaf kind of settlement in Vietnam in an effort to avoid a major war there. You know, I think let's face it, he had risen to political prominence during the McCarthy period. He had internalized the risks to a politician's career of being seen as soft on communism.
Yeah.
But I would say, and I think there's some evidence here to support me, that by the mid and late 1960s, the public debate around communism had changed to some extent, not night and day, but to some extent. And LBJ's fears of being brutally beaten up on by the right wing, by his political adversaries, if he failed to stand tall in Vietnam, were, I think, exaggerated. There may have been more of an opportunity for him than he was willing to realize to find some sort of face-saving, fig-leaf sort of solution that would have provided an off-ramp for the United States. Now, very likely that would have resulted over time in a sort of communist-dominated coalition in Vietnam or something like that. But, you know, that many people around LBJ believed that that was a price worth paying. Nobody welcomed that outcome, but many people believed that it was better than a big war, the outcome of which was hard to predict.
Whenever anyone talks about LBJ and foreign policy, it's hard to talk about anything other than Vietnam. It's just so big. It's just so there. What are some of the other ambitions he had? I mean, let's go right to your book, you know, The End of Ambition, the United States in the Third World in the Vietnam Era. What were some of LBJ's other ambitions, and what did the war in Vietnam do to those ambitions?
Yeah, well, I love that question. Yes. Well, you know, part of the story here is what I've already been rambling on about, which is his domestic ambitions.
Right, right,
and,
right.
You know, I think as presidents go, he's got to be like top three in terms of just how ambitious he was for remaking American society. But he also had a lot of ambitions in the international arena. You know, this was a president who wanted to wage a war on poverty at home, but he also had ambitions to use American aid, right, to promote development, to fight disease, internationally as well. Here, there was a lot of continuity, I think, with the JFK administration. So let's remember, it was the Kennedy administration who established the Peace Corps and who you know, ramped up American foreign aid and saw aid as a principal lever of American influence in the world. I think LBJ was, by and large, in the early parts of administration, on board with that approach. He believed that he could wage a war on poverty both at home and internationally. There wasn't a clear line between the two. But when circumstances forced him to prioritize, of course, he prioritized the domestic over the foreign. And I think what you see, and really what I'm getting at with the title of my book, is a dramatic retreat from that international ambition as Vietnam consumed, you know, his administration, and he became more pessimistic about what he could accomplish domestically as well. I think by 66, 67, 68, a lot of that ambition, particularly in the international realm, had faded away, and LBJ was trying his best to kind of hold on to whatever he could salvage from the earlier successes of his presidency.
So in 1964, you know, LBJ wins one of the greatest re-election margins, like, of all time. Sweeps it. 4 years later, you know, he's being primaried in his own party. He's got opponents on the other side. There's people chanting outside, "How many kids did he kill today?" You know, it's clear that his political star is falling. I'm curious, when you look at the decline of his popularity and his ability to be an effective politician, what percent would you like say this is Vietnam explains his fall from grace?
You're going to make me put a number on it. So I'm going to give you a number, but let me preface by saying that I think there's been a tendency over the years to put the number for the Vietnam War very, very high, right?
Yeah.
It was 90% Vietnam. Take the war out and things would have been dramatically different.
Right.
I might, you know, it sounds like a conveniently round number, but I think we should think in terms of 50% for Vietnam, because let's remember that at the same time LBJ was wrestling with Vietnam, he was also wrestling with unrest in American cities, the urban rioting, as we've tended to call it over the years, the backlash against the civil rights legislation of 64 and 65.
Yeah.
So the domestic context within which LBJ was trying to make policy was changing incredibly rapidly. I mean, those 5 years between 1964 and 1969, let's say, have to be among the most remarkable five-year stretches in all of American history in terms of the rapidity of social change. So policies and approaches, I think what we broadly call liberalism, this kind of notion of gradual change, relying on the power and instruments of government, was so front and center for so many Americans in 1964. It really underpins, I think, his sweeping election victory of that year. By 1968, a lot of Americans are really turning against that optimistic sense that you could solve problems by the right mix of expertise and resources and the right uses of governmental authority, in part because of Vietnam. A lot of people looked around and said, well, if this is the best that government can do, maybe government is not such a great place, you know, to place our bets. But there's an important domestic part to this as well. For a lot of Americans, the achievements of the Great Society started to look a little different by 1967, 1968. For many white Americans, you know, this story is pretty well known. A new mood of pessimism and conservatism, the, you know, the backlash, as it's sometimes been called, set in. And among African Americans and other groups that had been the assumed beneficiaries of many Great Society programs, there was also a kind of sense of disappointment and frustration because those programs, it turned out, didn't solve all the problems that needed to be solved. I mean, it's one of the great ironies that it's after the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act that you get this explosion of discontent. And I think if we sit back and think about it, it makes good sense that as expectations rise, you know, that the potential for upheaval becomes greater. But LBJ experienced this as a kind of puzzling and really horrible setback, given his sense of himself as trying to achieve all these great things. But you know, it's one of the cliches of the late 1960s that American society was kind of fragmenting increasingly years. And I think that's not a bad way to think about it. You know, conservatism was rising at the same time that radical movements were just demanding more, you know, more quickly. And all of these things are happening at the same time in a way that really pulled the rug politically out from under LBJ and the style of politics that he embodied and that he had really mastered. I think you could say as much as any president, you know, since FDR.
So as LBJ is leading the United States through this war, he was looking for peace. He was looking for a way out of it. And in his last year in office, you'll see reporting that he was close, but that Richard Nixon blocked him. Can you tell me about the Chenault affair? Explain what it is. How close was it? How true is it that Nixon got in the way?
Yeah, so it's an amazing episode about which we've learned a whole lot more in recent years, and probably will continue to learn more as new you know documentary evidence shakes out. So I don't think we've seen the last of this of the discoveries on this issue. So in the days leading up to the 1968 election, exactly as you say, the Johnson administration was really shifting into a higher gear, trying to get some sort of negotiating breakthrough that would presumably help Hubert Humphrey and enable the Democrats to avoid disaster. And also, by the way, burnish LBJ's legacy and reputation, right, as a peacemaker. Sure. So
it could have saved his whole legacy.
exactly. It was in that context that a woman named Anna Chenault, who was the Chinese-born wife of Claire Chenault, the American general, who had fairly conservative politics, very closely associated with the Republican Party. At any rate, Anna Chenault became a kind of go-between between the South Vietnamese government and the Nixon campaign. And the theory has been, the accusation has been that she worked hard to get the message to the South Vietnamese government that they should under no circumstances agree to any peace deal before the election. Richard Nixon, once he was president, would give them a much better deal that would protect South Vietnamese interests much more than anything that LBJ would agree to. You know, and there's some pretty remarkable evidence these contacts between Chenault and the South Vietnamese embassy and in Washington. LBJ found out about it through some wiretapping, which was in its own way fairly dubious, ethically and legally dubious. And you know, LBJ in a conversation that was captured on tape said to the Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen, you know, this amounts to treason. He uses the T word because, of course, it is illegal for a private citizen, which is what Richard Nixon was at that point, to engage in diplomacy with a foreign government. So, you know, my take on the Chenault affair is that it is indisputably interesting evidence about the Nixon campaign, about Richard Nixon's character, maybe about the lengths to which the campaign was willing to go to secure its best chance of of prevailing. But where I'm not as convinced is that this really made that much difference to the actual conduct of the negotiations. I don't think there's a lot of evidence that an agreement was right there, you know, if it weren't for the Chennault affair, you know, peace was at hand. I don't think there's any evidence that that was the case. And I also don't think, by the way, that the South Vietnamese government needed Anna Chennault or Richard Nixon, for that matter, to tell them what was plainly obvious. I have to believe to them that, you know, LBJ had strong incentive to end the war quickly and make compromises that might not be very helpful to the South Vietnamese government, and that they would do better to wait. You know, they were pretty savvy people who'd been defending their own interests for a really long time by that point. So I don't think they needed that kind of instruction.
Yeah, the great irony is 4 years later, very similar peace deal from Richard Nixon. So LBJ, he leaves office January 1969. He lives another 4 years to January 1973. United States would withdraw from Vietnam or kind of end the war, you know, a couple months later, March 73. So he watches the entire Nixon presidency, you know, escalations, drawdowns, everything. Do we have any sense of what he thought of how Nixon handled the Vietnam War?
Not a lot, to be honest. I think he didn't. I think very deliberately he didn't say much. And you know, I think there are different ways probably to interpret that silence. One way might be just to say, well, he was a bitter and frustrated individual who, you know, just didn't want to draw more attention to himself or make life more difficult for President Nixon and, you know, others who are trying to cope with this problem. Others might say, especially in the early parts of the Nixon administration, that LBJ actually believed that Nixon was by and large pursuing the same policy that he had been in the last parts of his presidency and wanted to kind of give Nixon a chance to implement those policies in hopes of salvaging some kind of victory out of the war. But unfortunately, it's a little hard to say because, you know, he simply kind of kept his mouth shut on Vietnam.
What's the legacy of LBJ's handling of the war in Vietnam?
You know, I think LBJ's handling of the war in the final analysis amounts to a case study in the demonstration of the limits of American power in the world. Now, you could even extend that to the domestic arena and say, you know, here's this man who sat atop a political movement that believed you could solve any problem through the right mix of goodwill and expertise and resources. And it turned out there were a lot of problems that really couldn't be solved, or you could just, in the best case, just chip away around the edges. So I think a lot of people came out of the 60s feeling a sense of, you know, frustration and disappointment that big things turned out to be a lot harder. And certainly this was the case in foreign policy, I would say generally, but Vietnam is, you know, the place to go, I think, for the best illustration of that demonstration of limits, you know. I'm hardly the first person to say this, you know, for a long time people have said, you know, the main lesson of the war in Vietnam is that Americans don't have a solution to every problem. And, you know, it turns out that no matter how many resources, how much force, how much goodwill, how much political support is pumped into a place beyond American borders, you know, those places can still defy American preferences. So, you know, I think that is, lots of people have said it, but I think that really is the big takeaway from the Johnson presidency's handling of Vietnam.
Do you think there's any lesson in leadership to be taken from how LBJ led through the Vietnam War?
Yeah. And, you know, here I fall back on something that I read a long time ago that made a deep impression on me. Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote this, who spent some time alongside LBJ. In fact, the quote that you read earlier was from one of her books about her book about LBJ. She says it later on in that same book, something that, as I mentioned, really stuck with me. LBJ was highly, maybe uniquely gifted in his ability to achieve legislative breakthroughs. During his time in the Senate, the master of the Senate, right? To use a phrase that has been often applied in connection with LBJ. And during his presidency, particularly the first couple of years, he made Congress work and achieved these enormous legislative breakthroughs as really no president, maybe FDR, you know, ever had. So he was an enormously skilled politician. There's just no question about that. But what Doris Kearns Goodwin has written and what really registered to me is that those same skills, those same leadership characteristics served him very poorly in foreign affairs, where you couldn't just throw resources and bring the experts around conference tables and, you know, marshal the necessary resources and solve the problems. That energy, that determination, you know, that LBJ showed in the domestic sphere turned out to be really counterproductive, I think, in Vietnam, maybe foreign policy more generally, because he didn't listen to the people who said this really can't be done, or this can't be done at a cost that we should have any interest whatsoever in paying. You know, the better move here is to cut losses, is to find some off ramp to make sure that you know, we don't wind up in a real mess. So it's curious, I think. Sometimes, you know, how do we come to terms with a man who has these incredible highs and these, you know, deep lows?
Yeah.
One way to do that is to think, is to make a claim that, okay, LBJ really knew what he was doing in domestic affairs and really didn't care that much or wasn't very good at foreign affairs. But another way to do it, the way Doris Kearns Goodwin does it, is to say, no, it was actually the same outlook, the same skills, the same political impulses that drove him in both spaces. But it turns out what's effective maybe in the domestic arena in the halls of Congress is not so great when it comes to waging a war or trying to understand a foreign society.
You know, it kind of feels like you never know what international situation you'll get as president. And he got the one that he was just worst made for. But it would have been so fascinating if instead he had been the president when, you know, the United States was meeting with Mao, or when Gorbachev was wanting to talk to the United States. Like, that would have been a fascinating, how would LBJ be able to use his individual power persuasion if he actually got to meet one of these foreign leaders and work with them? So,
Yeah, that's very true. He was really, to the extent he was successful in diplomacy, it was exactly what you're just mentioning, where he really excelled. You know, those conversations across a conference table. That was his milieu, I think.
In
Vietnam, you know, he famously on one occasion said, you know, if only I could get Ho Chi Minh across the conference table.
Right.
But, exactly. You know, to anyone who's read more than, you know, a book or two about Vietnam, you recognize how silly, you know, that kind of approach was. He imagined dealing with the Vietnamese like dealing with Richard Russell or Hubert Humphrey or Walter Reuther, right?
Yeah.
Everything could be bargained. Everything could be bargained. Everybody had their price, or everybody had their pressure points, you know, that could be used to influence them toward a compromise.
If you've enjoyed this interview with Mark and want to learn more about LBJ, I highly encourage you to check out the LBJ Presidential Library and Museum in Austin, Texas. It is a fantastic library. They have an animatronic LBJ who tells jokes and a lot of other fantastic exhibits. If you want to learn more about Vietnam, Mark has a number of books out there, including The End of Ambition, The United States and the Third World in the Vietnam Era, Assuming the Burden, Europe and the American Commitment to War in Vietnam, and The Vietnam War, A Concise International History. The LBJ Library and Foundation also hosts a podcast called The Bark Off, which is another podcast on presidential history. So if you like this show, you'll probably like that one. Thank you for your time, Mark.
Thanks so much, Kenny. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Abridged Presidential Histories. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, tell your friends and family about the show, and write a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform of choice. If you'd like to support the show, you can look it up on Patreon or go directly to www.patreon.com/abridgedpresidentialhistories. This helps me buy books and pay to host the show, and thank you so much to everyone who's contributed so far. The music in today's podcast is a public domain recording of the United States Army Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps. In our next episode, we will take a deeper dive on LBJ's Great Society, its inspiration, the battles behind it, and its lasting impact today. That's coming up next time on Abridged Presidential Histories.